from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Political pundit and former speechwriter for George W. Bush, David Frum, says President Trump's mishandling of the coronavirus pandemic will be a disaster for his reelection prospects and for the Republican Party as a whole. Coming up on Forum, David Frum will join us to talk about the Trump presidency in a pandemic and the president's threat this morning to shut down Twitter. And we'll talk about his new book, Trumpocalypse, Restoring American Democracy. Join us after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In his new book, Trumpocalypse, erstwhile neoconservative David Frum explores what he sees as the failures of conservatism from the Iraq War to the financial crisis to the Trump presidency. Former speechwriter for President George W. Bush, David Frum joins us now to talk about his book and how to reimagine a United States and a conservative party without Donald Trump. And welcome back to Forum, David Frum. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
I guess the place I'd like to begin with you is with what we would call breaking news, because it is indeed breaking news, and it does seem to, in many ways, dovetail with a lot of how you see President Trump operating, and I'm talking about his threat to shut down Twitter, and this is because, supposedly, of mail-in ballots being fraudulent. That's the charge that's been made. Nothing really to corroborate that, but Twitter is saying that he's going to be fact-checked, and he's saying that he will shut him down. Now, he's saying also that they are interfering with his right to free speech. I'd like you to just opine on this as you see it.
Well, President Trump has abused Twitter in a number of ways over the past 48 hours. I think the way that I find most ominous and revealing for what's ahead is his use of the Twitter platform to accuse Joe Scarborough, the morning TV host, absurdly. I mean, it's one of those things, it's so absurd that it's almost not offensive, although of course it is offensive too, of involvement in a murder case. Here's why this is so striking. If you or I were to use our Twitter feeds to accuse an innocent person of murder, we should prepare to lose our house in a defamation action. The president enjoys an almost total immunity from defamation and libel in the course of the president's official duties, and tweeting has been regarded as an official duty. So Donald Trump has a special privilege as president that he can say anything on Twitter without risking a libel action. And he's used that for this crazy personal errand. And it's an example of how we have built the presidency around a set of assumptions. And Trump has challenged those assumptions. And when he's challenged them, we've discovered the laws, the rules that we thought were there, they're not exactly there. There's no law to prevent the president from operating a private business while president and using the presidency to drive taxpayer money to his private businesses. We thought there was, but there wasn't. And so a big part of my argument in Trumpocalypse is I know there are many people who have the sunny American confidence that the institutions will protect you, but looking back on the past 3 years, the institutions have failed as often as they've succeeded.
Now, that's a central part of your argument. You had a separate piece in The Atlantic essentially putting that argument forward. I want to get back to what you said, though, about the Joe Scarborough incident episode, however we want to describe it, because the widower of the young woman who President Trump is charging his death Joe Scarborough is responsible for, asked for a retraction of those remarks, and essentially the president, of course, refused. But Jack Dorsey of Twitter also refused, and now he's got a little bit, according to Kara Swisher and others who seem to be having a pretty good pipeline here, he's getting a lot of the Twitter employees upset at him and rebellious.
Look, it's not possible for a private company to act as the guardian of the president of the United States. And I understand why people want to put this matter on Jack Dorsey, but it's just the issue is the president. And the issue, the agency that ought to oversee and check the president is not a private company, it's Congress. And Congress has gone missing again and again. I mean, here's another example of an institution that's failed. Congress has oversight powers over the executive branch that begin with subpoena. There's something we in Congress would like to know. Executive branch, please hand over the relevant documents so we can know it. And there's now a century and a half of court precedents on this question that say there are limits. I mean, they can't subpoena a private citizen's diary, but broadly within the executive branch, they can see just about anything they want to see, and they don't have to have a reason. If Congress could potentially legislate on a subject, even if they have no plan, they can get the documents. The Trump presidency has taken again and again the position, we do not have to comply with subpoenas from the other, from the House of Representatives because it's controlled by the other party. And they've gotten away with it. And this case, this question is now going to the Supreme Court. It will be decided probably at the end of June. And my prediction is that the Supreme Court will find a way to avoid answering the question until after the election, so that Trump, through his one and only reelection campaign, is going to get away with defying the subpoena power of Congress. These institutions have taken damage. And the institution that has taken the most damage, of course, is American leadership in the world. And so I'm trying in Trumpocalypse to assess, do a fair damage report, not to overstate, but not to understate, to make people understand why it matters and to offer a plan to do something about it.
I want to get to that plan with you, but let me focus for a moment on the institutions and the failure of these institutions as you see it. And we're really talking not only about Congress here, we're talking about the Justice Department, we're talking about intelligence. To a great extent, the argument goes that President Trump has put essentially those who are in lockstep with him, which the Senate is, or sycophants, in positions of power. I'm just wondering now, because I think, you know, we've had a number of, like you, former conservatives on. I don't know if I call you a former, you're still a conservative. You're still a believer in the Edmund Burke ethos and all that. But we've talked with people like Steve Schmidt and Rick Wilson and Max Boot. I would add George Conway here. A lot of those who are identified with the Lincoln Project, former Republicans, I would say, or former, now no longer Trump Republicans. And the question in my mind is, is this a counterforce? Is this PAC a counterforce? Can it be something to operate? They've already actually endorsed Vice President Biden. Where is the counterforce here? If it's not in the Lincoln Project and it's not in the institutions, where is it?
Trumpocalypse is dedicated to the libertarians, conservatives, and Republicans of Never Trump. And I quote an old Methodist hymn, when all were false, I found thee true. And I think I would say that of many, and these are my friends. You know, in 2017 and 2018, there was a jibe that came from the Trump people. Never Trump is not a political party, it's a dinner party. And people would sometimes add the even meaner codicil, it's a dinner party that met in my dining room. What we discovered in the election of 2018 was Never Trump Republicanism is the decisive force in American politics. And let me just go through it. And we're that constituency after constituency, the House of Representatives flipped. It didn't flip because Democrats won extra seats in the Bay Area, because they won extra seats in the mouth of the Hudson. They already had those seats. Where Democrats picked up seats, as they picked up the congressional seat that had belonged to George H.W. Bush. This is in the most affluent area of Houston. It had gone Republican in 66 and stayed Republican through Watergate, through Iran-Contra, through the Iraq War, through the financial crisis. A Democrat won it in 2018. Newt Gingrich's former district in an affluent suburb of Atlanta. Newt Gingrich picked it up in, I now forget whether it was 76 or 78. Again, stayed Republican for a generation through the financial crisis. And it went Democrat in 2018. Eric Cantor, who was the number two in the House of Representatives under President Obama, the number two Republican in the House of Representatives, his seat in an affluent area just northwest of Richmond, Virginia, went Democrat. The area just south of the Potomac River, around the CIA, if you know that part of Washington, which has been Republican for 60 of the past 66 years, it went Democrat. That the Democrats won the House of Representatives because a lot of conservative-leaning people who normally vote Republican, especially women, voted Democrat in 2018. And the reason President Trump is in so much trouble heading into his reelection in 2020 is because he is losing people who would normally be inclined to cast a Republican vote.
Again, if you just joined us, we're talking with David Frum, staff writer at The Atlantic and author of Trumpocalypse, Restoring American Democracy. I want to get into that restoration with you, David Frum, but how much of this is apparently what you see as a failure of conservatism? As I said, Iraq War to the financial crisis to Trump. and yet also has to do more significantly perhaps with the Tea Party, and with, as I think you point out in your book, there's no more intellectual elite in the conservative movement as there once was. And also one other factor that I want to bring in here, and that is figures like Mitch McConnell and many who are described as the enablers for Donald Trump. How much of this has to do, in other words, with Donald Trump as opposed to the conservative party, the Tea Party, the Republican Party failing and not having its intellectual elite that it once had as a kind of a stronghold?
Well, my two books on the subject, they form a cycle, Trumpocracy, which is a study of how Trump gained and used power in 2018, and now Trumpocalypse, an assessment of how Donald Trump has used his power and a prediction and projection of what to do next. Try to make the frame of the story bigger than Donald Trump personally. And here's the way I would tell it. And everyone will have their own point of view, of course, and I'm not saying mine's canonical, but here's how I see it. I knocked on doors for Ronald Reagan as a college student in 1980. I spent my adult life working in the conservative world in the Republican Party, served President George W. Bush as a speechwriter, was at the American Enterprise Institute until 2010 when I was sacked for something I wrote. This is my world. I think we did a lot of good in the period between about 1978 and 2001. Inflation was stopped. The Cold War was ended peacefully. I think the American economy was deregulated in ways that made it more dynamic. People don't remember this now, but you used to, every time you moved a truck with a crate of lettuce across the country, that truck had to file a route map with a federal agency. Stockbroker commissions were regulated. The interest on checking accounts was regulated. It was all left over from the Depression and the war, and it stopped making sense. So this period from 78 to 2001 is a tremendously creative period. And I think the conservative movement, it's not perfect, but it contributed a lot of good things to the government of the country. But political ideas are products of their times, and they stop working after a while. They're not eternal truths. They're not laws of science. They're not laws of morality. They're just attempts to solve problems together. And the conservative ideas in which I'd grown up, they just stopped applying so well. And so we had a series of disappointments and defeats and the Iraq War and the financial crisis. But where things really begin to go radically wrong, in my opinion, is after 2010. We have a slow recovery from the financial crisis. So Republicans gain a lot of seats in 2010, 12, and 14. Meanwhile, their ideology is moving ever farther away from where the country is. And they are realizing that their hope is to use especially the census of 2010 and the redistricting afterwards to rewrite the map of American politics so that with fewer and fewer votes, you can control more and more power. And
they get a boost. David, this goes back to the Southern strategy of John Mitchell and the Nixon administration. It goes back also to the idea that somehow if you get evangelicals on your side and people who are opposed to abortion and who stand firm with you politically, that you can get a new populist majority. And that was essentially what the Republican Party signed on for, wasn't it?
This is not just Southern. A state, for example, probably the state with the most distorted map in the entire country is Wisconsin, which is about as far north as you get before you bump into Canada. And let's remember that when it was George W. Bush who in 2005 reauthorized the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which expires at intervals. Republicans did try to compete and they did pick up votes in the white South, and Democrats did better and better in the non-white South. But something really did change in 2010. Before 2010, parties did not admit to themselves they were trying to prevent their opponents from voting. For one thing, we did have the Voting Rights Act until it was substantially gutted by the Supreme Court in 2013. So we're into a new era. And the other thing is the Republican Party was more competitive before 2010. It wins the popular vote in 1984 and 1988. And it wins a majority of the popular vote in 2004. But after 2004, it never wins a majority of the popular vote in a presidential election ever again. And its share of the vote, even in congressional elections, begins to decline. And it confronts this new problem of how do we squeeze out of a smaller and smaller share of the vote more and more power in a way that is very different from the political problems before 2005.
Well, forgive me, one of the ways that seemed evident when you were working for President George W. Bush was to at least be more open to immigration and to the idea of allowing immigrants to come into the country. That was a tactic, frankly, that didn't work. And when President Trump took a very, shall we say, antithetical tactic, it did work for his Republicanism, his brand of Republicanism. And I'm also thinking about guns and so many other things that Republicans turned to under Trump that seemed to work for them with a kind of populist element to it, the sort of thing that Steve Bannon was behind. I'm just interested, though, in getting your thought. You mentioned knocking on doors for Ronald Reagan, and your title suggests something theological, and I want to get to that because there was, under Ronald Reagan, even the idea of the rapture and the idea that, you know, we were headed to a whole different era and could count on theologically moving into a different era. This became, in many ways, a drumbeat of the Republican Party, didn't it?
Well, look, religious rhetoric is as American as apple pie. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord, we sang during the civil rights, during the Civil War. And Teddy Roosevelt, when he invented the Progressive Party in the early 20th century, his great speech and at their convention said, "We stand at Armageddon and we battle for the Lord." That's how American politics talks. Barack Obama, I mean, so much of the power of his rhetoric derived not only from the rhythms of the Black church, but from the language and theology of the Black church. This is now changing in the 21st century. Americans have been a profoundly religious people. So of course their religion influences the way they think about politics. And that's just part of the national character. But I want to say something about, you make this point about things working for Donald Trump. It's important to understand Donald Trump has been a profoundly unpopular president. He's, in fact, the most unpopular first-term president in the history of polling. He's never once been above 50% in any reputable poll. And this is his project is to grope for political resources when he doesn't have actually a voting majority behind him. He wouldn't have to be so crazy if he were popular. But
you know the argument, David. The argument is that Donald Trump's support is throughout the country. Hillary Clinton's popular vote had to do with the East Coast and the West Coast and the big cities, particularly in the East Coast and the West Coast. So the argument goes, and I'm just stating this because one hears it particularly from the GOP now, that the people are still behind President Trump. And the numbers, despite what you're talking about in terms of polls, belie the fact that the most support you find for Democrats and for the alternate party is in the big cities on the East and West Coast.
Well, look, the rocks and tumbleweeds are behind President Trump, no question. And although I haven't done much polling among the Buffalo, he does well. Where the Buffalo roam, he does well. Where people live, he doesn't do so well. And this is actually a major theme of Trumpocalypse, is how do we bring the American political system in line with the wishes of the American majority? It is something of a talking point to say, well, we're not a democracy, we're a constitutional republic. But I think many of us thought, well, I always understood we were a democracy. And if we're not, then we jolly well should be. And how do we make it more of one?
Well, one of the things that you come out with, a little bit of a surprise to me, especially when you go through this kind of discourse, keep the Electoral College.
Well, when I say keep the Electoral College, I mean acknowledge that you need a constitutional amendment to get rid of the Electoral College. And it's not going anywhere so fast. And come up with projects. The projects for reform that fill the second half of Trumpocalypse are all projects that can be done by simple majority vote real fast. So I'm not, I want to show, and there's probably going to be a pretty short window. I assume Vice President Biden is going to win in 2020, and I think he'll do well in the Senate. But if we have a slow recovery from our economic troubles, and that's something you have to take into count as a real possibility, then he may suffer reverses in 2022, just the way President Obama suffered reverses in 2010, that there may be a pretty small window here to do meaningful reform. And the other date to bear in mind is that the census of 2020 calls for the redistricting in 2021. So if you want to correct imbalances at the state level, 2021 is the year to do it. And for the federal government, 2023 is maybe the deadline. So I'm offering feasible acts. So I propose, for example, first day of the new Senate, just get rid of the legislative filibuster. A decade ago, we got rid of the judicial filibuster. Just the Senate has become so much more unrepresentative than it ever was that even 50 votes in the Senate doesn't represent anything like a majority of the country. To make it artificially 60, that's not in the Constitution, that's not in the law. Get rid of it. Get rid of it on the first day. There'll be some squawking, but it'll happen. And once you've done that, then on a party line vote, you can make a state out of the residential areas of the District of Columbia. And then you would add two more senators, probably Democrats, probably people of color. And the District of Columbia will, by the way, have more people than Wyoming, Vermont, Alaska, or North Dakota. And it is a much bigger net contributor to the federal treasury than I think a dozen at least of the states that are already states. So it's got enough people, it's got enough wealth. Make it a state. That it's not a miracle. It doesn't change everything, but it balances the Senate a little more. And at the state level, use the redistricting of 2021. And one of the things I propose is that Democratic states drop two maps, the map of what they should do and the map of what they could do. And they say to their Republican counterparts in states that could be competitive, like Georgia, Texas, look, here we are. We now hold Wisconsin and North Carolina for the time being. This is the map that gives you a fair chance through the rest of this decade. And here's the map that doesn't give you a fair chance. Why don't you adopt a fair map that gives us a chance in your state, and we'll adopt a map that gives you a chance in our state? And if not, not.
Well, you're also talking about some deals that I thought were original and ways that might tie in with a Biden victory, if indeed you're right about Biden being the next president of the United States, where he's able to work across party lines. That's part of his tradition. And you're talking about actually making immigration tougher in exchange for social and climate legislation and having a carbon tax. I mean, there's a whole kind of plan that you've put in here. And I want to remind listeners that we're talking to David Frum, and his book is Trumpocalypse, Restoring American Democracy. I also want to remind listeners that you can join this program, and I invite you to do that now. If you have something you'd like to ask or say to David Frum, we'd like to hear from you. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, and you can join us now at that number. Again, feel free to be part of the program. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions you might have to forum@kqed.org. We're coming up on a break here. We've got seconds left, but let me just read a quick tweet here from a listener. It says, how did the Tea Party play into Trump's rise, and how is it Republicans now accept sweeping executive power when so much of the Obama era was marked by conservatives complaining about executive overreach? We got seconds left. David, I'd like you to respond to that quickly, if you could.
Bad faith is a powerful human motivator.
Very cogent. Okay, we'll be back. We'll hear more from David Frum. We'll also hear from you, our listeners. Feel free to join the program. We do want to hear from you. And again, you can join us by phone at 866-733-6786. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with David Frum, staff writer for The Atlantic, author of Trumpocalypse, Restoring American Democracy, and also the author of the well-known signature notion of the Axis of Evil during the Bush administration, where he was a speechwriter. Axis of Evil, of course, was all about Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. And we got a lot of callers here, and a lot of people want to speak with you, David. But before we go to our callers and also read some emails and get your responses to those and tweets and whatnot, I just have to ask you, because it's become a major kind of bone of contention. Steve Schmidt, another member of the Lincoln Project, has come out and said that he holds Trump responsible for so much of the economic collapse we have now, as well as, well, the many of the deaths reaching close to 100,000. How much do you hold him responsible for those, where we are now with the pandemic?
Trump obviously didn't cause the pandemic, and many countries where he does not govern have had severe economic effects. So you can't hold him wholly responsible. As president, you're responsible for how you respond to crises. The crisis originates outside of you. Your job is to manage it. And you know, Donald Trump's defenders will say things like, well, yeah, none of this is his fault because it happened outside the United States. But the whole reason we hire presidents is to have someone there to respond. So the response has been a failure. And I think we can, I wrote a big article for The Atlantic sort of itemizing the timeline that shows why he failed. Through December and January, Donald Trump's top priority was to negotiate some face-saving trade deal to escape the trade war he had started against China that was weighing so heavily on his re-election prospects. Remember, through the second half of 2019, the economy was looking kind of soggy because of the shock of these trade difficulties. So he was building toward a big trade deal in January of 2020, and he didn't want anything to distract from that. And so he ignored everything untoward from China that wouldn't save his neck. And that is the real, and that plus his inability to process bad news and things that bore him, things that require him to rely on experts, meant that we lost months and months. So this crisis was much worse than it had to be. It was going to be bad no matter what, but it didn't have to be this bad.
What about what someone like Charles Blow of the New York Times says, which is essentially that there is much blood on Trump's hands because in mid-March he was still telling the American people there was nothing to worry about, this pandemic would be over, and there simply weren't going to be more deaths.
Right. Well, Trump is a fantasist. I mean, his method has always been, and this is, I think, a big part of how he engages the world, that he tries to sell you the idea that this disgusting-looking steak is really a great steak, that this fake university is a real university, that this multi-level marketing scam is the way you are going to find your way to fame and fortune. So that's the way he's done the presidency. And he had enough wind at his back for the first 3 years that it seemed to do well enough. I have this, you know, my observation, he's the rooster who took credit for the sunrise. And now he finds the sun setting and he desperately wants to not take blame for the sunset, but he didn't cause the sunrise in the first place either.
Here's a caller. Paul joins us. Paul, you're on the air. Welcome.
I had two very quick questions. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to ask what you thought about making Puerto Rico a state, one, and two, having an independent panel to draw the districts as we have here in California, but nationally.
Yeah, great. Those are two great questions. On Puerto Rico, my instinct would be if you had, I worry, I'm originally from Canada, I would worry about bringing into the United States a state that is not unequivocally committed to American statehood. If where you have a significant nationalist group that wants, that is thinking about independence, I would say I would want to see something like a 65% commitment in Puerto Rico to statehood, because I would be worried about the impact both on them and on the rest of the country. Unless you had that kind of wholehearted commitment to the country. That's obviously not an issue here in the District of Columbia, where no one imagined, you know, 99% of us would like to be a state. As for, I am so with the caller, it is madness to me that the United States, alone among democracies, entrusts politicians with the job of drawing their borders. That's, but I want a solution that's available in the next 2 years. And while obviously independent commissions are the right answer, in the meantime, we need a restored deterrence, politician to politician, so one party does not do what the Republicans did after the census of 2010.
I was just struck also remembering Puerto Rico when they were in such dire straits and President Trump went down there and was throwing paper towels. And it sort of keyed off in my mind a memory during the campaign when he said, and he said many things like this, of course, nobody can be more presidential than I will be. And here you have, just recently on Memorial Day, the president standing up and presumably memorializing the dead. And he did say some things that were prepared remarks, but then going into attacks on his political opponents, including Congressman Lamb from Pennsylvania, whom he called an American fraud. I mean, just in your sense of things, especially remembering the idea of what constitutes being presidential, I mean, this is just your response to those kind of that kind of behavior generally.
Well, look, there's so many examples of this. After he went to France to mark the 100th anniversary of the end of the First World War, and then he got petulant and pouty, and you know, again, and didn't go to the event, and then told lies about why he didn't go to the event. And there's no limit. George W. Bush said to an interviewer once a great thing. He said, the reason they built the Oval Office as an oval is so that there'd be no corners to hide in. The office finds you out. You can't hide from it. It finds your deficiencies, and every human being who's ever been president and ever will be has deficiencies. It finds your strengths. It tests your empathy, and it tests your toughness too, because the president can't just be empathetic. Presidents often have to say no, and they often have to make decisions where some lives are saved and others are lost. You know, there's a reason why we assign the president his or her own personal doctor. It's a really hard job. There's a reason why by the end of 8 years of it, you look like a tale from the crypt. Donald Trump, it found him out. And the whole world now sees the sad, shabby person that he is.
You remember President Trump had a personal doctor who said that no president, words perhaps that ventriloquist Trump put in his mouth, maybe not, but no president has ever been as healthy as President Trump. And I remember reflecting on that. Does he know the health of James Garfield or Benjamin Harrison? How does he make a statement like that? But it resonates in my memory. I'm sorry. I get a caller on here from Nevada. That's Brian. Brian joins us. Brian, welcome.
Thank you. David, to your point on Democrats being in the cities and the coastal areas, what's Biden's strategy to win the Midwest states, which always seem to be pivotal? The Iowa, Illinois, Massachusetts, that's more of an East Coast, but the Midwest states. Thank you.
I think Biden's strategy to win the Midwest is to run against an incumbent president who's presiding over total economic collapse in the Midwest. I think now something like 1 in 5 people in Michigan has lost their jobs just in the past 60 days. Of course, Michigan has been very, very hard hit by the pandemic. I don't think it was Biden could ever have expected that Trump would mock the governor of the state and refuse to help out during a pandemic. But I think that's, you know, saying little words of amazement and thanksgiving when Trump does do that. I don't think Biden needs a strategy. I mean, I think that Trump is collapsing. I also think one more point about this is to remember that the map is not always the same map. And in 2020, this election is going to be fought not only in the Midwest, but in Arizona and in North Carolina as well.
You can also see pretty much the earmarks of the Trump campaign gearing up not only to tie Biden to China and being too soft on China, but also to his son and Hunter Biden. And there are lots of things now. I mean, this latest thing with Charlemagne, they're probably going to use as well, the charges of Tara Reid. In other words, there's a lot of grist, and there are those who will respond and say, well, there's more grist against Trump. But Trump's following, some argue, is much more loyal than Joe Biden's following. Does he inspire, you know, the Bernie bros, for example, to go out and vote for him, or the millennials?
Trump does have a very intense base, and he's got the advantage of the map has been drawn to favor him. But much of what Trump does, there's a wonderful political story told by a former White House colleague of mine, Karen Hughes. She's on vacation on the beach, and she sees one of these planes pulling an advertising flyer behind it. And the flyer says something like, Jill, come back. I'm miserable without you, Jack. And she thinks, bad message, Jack. Too much about you, not enough about her. And most of Donald Trump's messaging is about things he cares about. Like, Obama was mean to me. The FBI was mean to me. Meanwhile, we have 40 million Americans who are out of work. We have 100,000 at least who are dead. We have many more who will be sick and suffering soon. They want you to talk about them. Donald Trump is incapable of doing it because he actually cannot absorb the reality of other human beings.
But he can, and I wonder, I think you've said this on a couple of occasions, incite a culture war, and probably in many instances is capable of doing that in many people's minds in order to divert attention.
That's his great resource. There are many dangerous divisions in American society, and he's very good at exploiting those, turning American against American. In the immediate perspective, the economic disaster overwhelms it. But in the longer view, we have to begin to address these divisions between city and country, between the generations, between social classes, and between men and women, by the way. This is one of the great resources that Donald Trump has. We have never seen, among in the history of American statistics. I mean, it has never been more likely that people under 30, men and women, live apart one from the other. And as they don't find each other, they become incredibly men and women, different cultural groups. And there's a lot of, and everyone who's been involved in social media can see this. That was one of the themes of the Bernie versus Elizabeth Warren campaign, this kind of male rage of all these unattached young men. We have to address that. And I talk about that in Trumpocalypse too.
Yes, you do. Again, David Frum, our guest, his book, Trumpocalypse. And our next caller, John, joining us from Hutchinson, Kansas. John, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, how are we doing, guys? I cited a 2010 piece from Christopher Hitchens many times, which cited the rise of populist parties in Europe and how the U.S. would be faced with something similar. I'm curious how you see the relationship between European populism and where it is rising elsewhere.
Thank you for that question. Yeah, go ahead, David Frum.
A lot of my work on the Trump presidency started with a month-long reporting trip my wife and I did in Hungary in the spring of 2016. And I had, since 2014, done a lot of work on these movements, and they are coming not only to Europe, but they're also coming to emerging democracies. You see similar tendencies in Brazil, in India, and in Mexico. You've got a populist of the left, an authoritarian populist of the left, López Obrador, who uses many of the same tricks. This is very much a global problem, and I think to understand it, we need a global perspective. That's why comparing Donald Trump to previous figures in American history is not always illuminating. You need to sometimes compare him to people who are farther in space and closer in time. I think in all the cases, the mass migration from the South, the global South to the global North is, I think, a forcer. Since between 1990 and 2015, about 44 million people moved from the global South to the global North. And that has been a tremendous source of social pressure. I talk in Trumpocalypse about things that all the developed countries have to do to manage that movement and to slow it. I think we are all dealing with the aftershock of the disappointing levels of economic growth since 2010 as well.
Question for you, David, from a listener named James, who writes, it seems to me that anyone involved in the GOP at the highest levels over the past, over the last 50 years is complicit in the Southern strategy and paved the way for Trump. How have you in the past differentiated yourself from the strategy, and how have you publicly protested it?
Well, look, I don't know quite what people mean by Southern strategy. I mean, if it means that the Republican Party, which had been locked out of the South, began competing there much more effectively, then that's a good thing. I don't think you can tell yourself a morality tale where there's a good party and a bad party and it goes back 100 years and we're always on the side of good. I mean, that I think that the nature of politics is there's truth everywhere. And when you have a two-party or multi-party system, the system advances by balancing truth against truth. In politics, everything is only partially or provisionally true. And there are truths that conservatives have access to and truths that liberals have access to, and you balance one against the other. It really is true that you can make your government too big, too expensive. It can be too regulatory, too burdensome, and that needs to be challenged. It's true, too, that just as it's dangerous to always look at the world through the suspicious eyes of the more hawkish person, it's dangerous to look at it always through the believing and trusting eyes of the two liberal, one against the other. And the way the American system, the difference in the American system and, say, the British, in a parliamentary system, the way you balance the ship is one party gets a lot of power and then the other, and then they lose after a while, and the other party gets their turn. And you get a kind of zigzagging motion. In America, it's never quite clear where the power is. You know, who's the government? Is it the president or the speaker of the House of Representatives, who's like the prime minister in a British system? And so instead of sharp alternations between powers, between parties, you have kind of negotiation and the search for consensus within the congressional system. That's how the American system ends up operating.
But couldn't you have seen, or to some extent, at least look forward to the idea that things were moving toward. In fact, in your book, you talk about something called white ethnic chauvinism, when you single out George Wallace and you single out Pat Buchanan as cultural warriors. I mean, couldn't you have seen that coming and around the corner? It was moving more and more toward that kind of white ethnic chauvinism in the party, in the GOP.
My very first book, published in 1994, called Dead Right, predicted the rise of ethno-nationalism as the most important force in 21st century politics. It predicted both the decline of religious commitment in the United States, and it predicted the rise of ethno-nationalism. That's one of the things I got right in my early career as a political observer. So yeah, I saw it coming. I saw that coming. And I wrote a lot in the 2000s about these tendencies in the United States and around the world. I've been on this story for a long time. But where I can't follow you is to say, and therefore Ronald Reagan was wrong to cut taxes in 1981. That I think, you know, is taking something that is a true observation and turning it into a polemical an ideological point that, you know, people can believe if they want to, but I don't.
Well, here's a tweet from Lisa who says the Conservative Party brought Trump to bear and has used every minute of his reign to accomplish its agenda. With or without Trump, this is the GOP. In fact, I guess you would agree with that, wouldn't you? This is Trump's party now, the Republican Party.
It's Trump's party now. That doesn't mean that's the way it has to stay. And a lot of my work is devoted to changing that. The United States is going to stay a two-party system. And I believe in two-party systems. In California, where you effectively have one party, what happens is you convert party politics into factional politics. And for citizens, factional politics is very dangerous because it's just too hard to understand what is going on. If you are not someone who's following politics closely, you get the rough differences between Republicans and Democrats. And in competitive states, people can make informed choices that way. But in a state like California, you have to keep track of dozens of little factions and know, you know, there's minute differences between different types of mayor of Los Angeles. And that's not information that's very accessible to anybody who doesn't follow closely. And so you disempower people because they don't have this way of getting the information they need to make an informed vote. So I believe in two-party politics, and I think that we're going to have it as long as we have the Electoral College. And I don't think, just as the Democratic Party survived this being on the wrong side of the Civil War, and the Republican Party survived being on the wrong side of the Great Depression, so it will survive being on the wrong side of Donald Trump. The challenge for people like me, my friends, the Steve Schmitz and the George Conways, is how do we make this a party that no longer competes by trying to prevent people from voting? That says, let's just take that off the table. Everyone's going to vote. And you have to compete now as a center-right party in a truly democratic political system.
Well, what do you think of a president who says mail-in votes is partisan and it works on behalf of the Democrats? This is a president who did mail-in voting himself, by the way. But that has been his position. And that's, by the way, seems to be the position of the Republican Party for the most part, because, once again, they're lockstep with this president.
Look, there are technical issues connected to mail-in ballots. I mean, there was fraud in 2018, ironically committed by a Republican candidate in North Carolina using mail-in ballots. And mail-in ballots raise issues in certain places like nursing homes. If states allow prisoners to vote, I think there'll be some questions about how do you maintain the secrecy of the ballot in a prison context. But in general, this is an issue for specialists. The point is people should be voting, and we should be thinking how we can empower that in ways that are safe and secure and honest. And I'm not an expert at all on the technology of the ballot. That's not my subject matter. What I am talking about and what I know a bit about is how we are using these excuses, the genuine issues of ballot security, as excuses to prevent predictable blocks of people from voting.
Well, President Trump has already said that this is going to be a rigged election. He said that, in fact, after he won against Hillary Clinton. And to some extent, the whole attack on mail voting seems to me to be just very difficult to comprehend, especially since the president set up a commission to investigate what was supposed to be fraudulent voting up in New England, New Hampshire specifically, and they came up with nothing. I mean, there hasn't been any evidence yet to essentially corroborate any of those charges. Let me get your response, though, David, to a question from a listener named Matt, who says, certainly seems to me that Trump will not accept defeat under any circumstances. If his polling continues to drop and it becomes obvious that he will lose to Biden as we get closer to the election, do you worry that he will pull a terrible political stunt, a war with China or Iran, to get the country to rally around the commander-in-chief?
Well, what Trump has learned to his sorrow is that the country does not rally around the commander-in-chief, that there was a very small rally effect in February and March because of the epidemic. But you contrast what has happened to governors, and you contrast what has happened to political leaders elsewhere in the world, where, you know, leaders like, you know, Emmanuel Macron in France and Boris Johnson in Britain, they picked up 30, 40 points. I'm not permanently, because those are from, but people say, you know, okay, I'm with, you know, I salute, I'm with you for the time being. I hope in the best. You know, that happened to Justin Trudeau. He got a bump in the polls, which again, you know, normal politics eventually returns. Donald Trump didn't get that. He got like picked up, I think, 2 or 3 points and picked them up for a couple of weeks. So if he imagines that starting a war with China is going to make him popular, I think he understands actually that that's not true. And so he avoids those kinds of confrontations. What I worry about the most is, should he be defeated, how he helps himself to everything that isn't nailed down, how he will pardon criminal associates, how he will pardon his relatives, how he may try to pardon himself. It's very controversial whether a president can do that. That's one of those questions that just didn't come up, or whether he might try some other trick, step aside in favor of Vice President Pence and have Vice President Pence then pardon him. I think it will be a moment of danger. I don't think the danger will be the obvious one of trying to interfere with the election. I think it will be a more subtle one of poisoning the country so that Biden can't govern it. One thing he might do, for example, is put in place some very deflationary economic measures between November and January, hoping to make the depression that's already here last longer and be deeper so that it costs the Democrats seats in 2022.
Let me bring Lewis aboard here. Lewis, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. Hello. I just wanted to ask a quick question to the guest. He was a speechwriter for George Bush, and my question was, how did Bush essentially give rise to Trump? How did Bush's administration and their views on the executive play into the way that Donald Trump has run his executive? And
David Frum.
I don't agree that that's true. I'm going to read the caller's mind a little bit as to what he has in mind. Bush used a lot of executive powers, but some of which were encoded in statutes, like, the Patriot Act was a statute, it wasn't just something that the president asserted. But because of the 9/11 emergency, presidential power tended to grow. It grew a lot under Barack Obama as well. Because he faced such a difficult Congress after 2010 that he became a practitioner of executive orders. I mean, the whole President Obama himself repeatedly said he didn't have the power to do something like the deferred action for young illegal aliens that he then did do. I mean, having spent years saying he couldn't do it, he then tried to do it by executive order, ran into some trouble in the courts. But the difference between then and now is Bush and Obama, I mean, they pushed executive power and in ways that we may need to revisit. But they were acting in the public interest, as they saw. They are very different kinds of presidents from Donald Trump, who's been acting in his own interest. And so while there are specific things that need there to be remedied, that's my concern is not just how do you rebalance the power between the president and Congress, but how do you deal with these larger faults in the country that create resources for such presidents as Donald Trump. We want never to have a personality like this in office again. How do you avoid it? And that means dealing with some of these deeper issues that I talk about in the second half of Trumpocalypse.
And again, our guest is David Frum, and his newest book is Trumpocalypse, Restoring American Democracy. Here's Tom, who writes, Fox News has spent 20 years teaching its audience to hate facts and love bullies. The faction of Americans who follow the orders issued by their masters at Fox are people who will support Trump regardless of the harm that he inflicts on our country. I'll talk about the role of Fox News in the ascendancy of Donald Trump. David?
The biggest show on Fox News is Sean Hannity. I forget it now, 9 o'clock Eastern time. And any given night, somewhere between 2.5 million and 3 million people are watching Hannity. So let's assume they're not always the same 2.5 million. Let's say he's got an audience of maybe three times that of people who watch some Hannity, 9 or 10 million. This is a country of 330 million people. What's driving everybody else? And I think one of the things when you think about media, as we get older, we think about media in ways that we have inherited from our youth. It's important to remember the most important media company in this country by far is not Fox, it's Facebook. Now, Facebook refuses to admit that it's a media company. It disclaims the responsibility of a media company, but that's what it is. After Facebook, probably YouTube is the second most important media company in the country, owned by Google. And they won't accept that they're a media company. And I think we have our biggest media problem is in 1970, the most important media companies, the TV networks, agreed they were media companies, understood they had some responsibilities. They were there to make a living, obviously, but they understood their business and accepted the responsibilities of their business. Today's big media companies refuse to admit they're media companies and refuse to accept the responsibilities of being a media company.
It's a conservative point of view, isn't it?
I'm a pretty conservative person.
Yeah, you still are. Well, we'll keep your bona fides on that score, and it's good to have you back with us on Forum. Just a quick response maybe to somebody pushing back. ASA says, can we stop the whole no one lives where Trump does well rhetoric? People live there. They just live differently. Is it less people? Yes, but still people.
Yeah, obviously it's still people, of course. I mean, and we respect them. And if there are three people in one place, they are human beings with rights. Do they get to pick a government over the objections of 27 people? Should it be, you know, then no, that sometimes they also have responsibilities. And one of the responsibility is when you're outvoted to accept with good grace and then to work harder to build a new coalition that allows you to have more authority.
I'll have to leave it there. David, thank you for joining us. David Frum, again, a staff writer at The Atlantic, former Bush speechwriter and author of Trumpocalypse, Restoring American Democracy. More of Forum up ahead. Stay with us. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.